From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for April the 2nd, 2017, the first Sunday in April, opening night of the baseball season with the Cubs. This is our weekly look behind the politics and policies that make or don't make Chicago, the state, and Washington, D.C. run. Time to grab the Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, we'll try to get your day and your week off to a great start. Wow, busy, busy, busy sports day. Busy sports weekend. We've got the Blackhawks playing Boston, their final regular season home game at the United Center. John and Troy have all the action right here with the puck dropping at 11:30. And then tonight, the World Series champion Chicago Cubs begin their attempts for a repeat at Busch Stadium in St. Louis, and that's at 7:25 tonight. I got to tell you guys, it's hard to believe it's already baseball season after such a short offseason, but then again, as Cub fans, we've never had a short offseason in anyone's lifetime.
That's right, and you're right, Rick. It just seemed like an awful short period of time between the end of last year and baseball and now picking up this year. And, of course, we've been watching preseason exhibition stuff anxiously to see just what might happen this year,
too. Yeah, and it looks like the bats are going to go well. I think I mentioned the other day about David Axelrod writing a piece in the New Yorker and about, you know, keeping an eye on the pitching. But the bats seem to be for, I know it's spring training, but now it starts to count. And if you're going to show what you're made of, no better way to start against St. Louis.
And they're in St. Louis. Sam, are you there?
Barely.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures from Arizona.
Good morning.
Good morning, Schwani. Yeah, it's interesting because, Rick, Schwani texted me, I think it was 2 days ago, saying he's watching Tampa Bay and Philly, a random spring training game. So even Schwani's ready for some baseball.
I was watching, on the MLB channel. I happened to just be watching some spring training baseball, and I've been keeping tabs on this.
And he's in full regalia. Full Cubs regalia today.
As I said, I paid good money for this clothing. I'm going to wear it. When is the home opener for the Cubs, Sam?
Home opener would be on the 10th of April. It's a week after the White Sox won. So the White Sox open this Monday, and the Cubs open the Monday after.
Right. Okay. Okay. Very good.
But I will tell you, Dave, you're looking good in the champion Cubs hat and the champion sweatshirt.
Yeah, as I said, you know, you paid money for this clothes, you got to wear them.
And it's the debut.
Wear them proudly.
It's the debut, right?
This is the debut. That's right. I got this just after the, there was a pop-up store across the street, the truth be known, where they were selling official Major League Baseball Cubs wear.
Stress and, official there. And they weren't knockoffs.
No, these were not knockoffs. This is the real deal. And they were about ready to close, which meant that they were discounting things. And even though it was the day before they closed, you thought, well, everything's going to be picked over and not much to choose from. There was a lot of stuff left available. And so I took advantage of it, paid good money for it. But
yes, you did.
I just, when I got it home, I thought, all right, I'm putting this away and we'll bring this out for the next season, for the 2017 season. So here we are.
Well, and I was very torn because I'm going to the Hawks game this morning after the show. But
interesting that it's the Hawks game this morning, but that is the case.
Yes. But I thought about wearing my Cubs hat, but it just the kind of looked too much of a sports mishmash, you know?
Oh.
Would that be appropriate?
Clashing colors, perhaps?
Well, yes.
I've seen so much worse. Honestly, you'd be fine. People wear their personalized sweaters. I think the personalized sweater is just, I don't know. It's too much for me. If you're a grown man, get somebody else's sweater. Don't you're not 12 years old.
I never understood that, the personalized sweater thing. And you're right.
Pearson
for
number
kids,
99, you just don't need it.
I would never wear Gretzky's number, okay?
This means I can't wear the Schwanee number 13 shirt, can I?
Have you got one?
No.
I think you're past that age, Schwanee. I'm sorry to inform you.
Way past that age.
Well, if it says Schwanee on it, you might be able to get away with it.
Yeah.
That personalized shirt thing, I've never really understood at all. But I'll be probably wearing my Bobby Hull number 9 sweater over there.
That's good.
As I'm wearing now. And a great story about what I asked a friend of mine, and he went to get this for me. And, of course, I told him I wanted Glenn Hall. And of course, what do I get is Bobby Hull. So I guess my French-Canadian speaking skills were not adequate enough for getting the proper sweater. But nevertheless, looking forward to this game. It's a original six matchup with Boston. And as Sam said, we've clinched the conference championship. And so we've got at least home playoff ice for the first three rounds, as we assume we'll going to be going deep this season. And Sam, Dave told me you made a bold prediction about the Hawks.
Yeah, well, back in January, we were on Saturday morning. I think we even talked about it here on your show, Rick, but I just think that they're as deep as they've been on the blue line. They can throw seven or eight guys out there defensively. Third line on offense is very deep. It's going to be probably Hartman, Kruger, and Hossa. You'll have Anisimov back to center Kane and Panarin. Of course, you've got Taves on top with probably Schmaltz and Panik, a goaltender that has two cups, and the second winningest coach in the history of the league. Plus, they're well-rested. It's a great equation.
Yeah, I wasn't so concerned when they kind of just chunked that 7-0 game. I was more concerned when they were up 4-1 and lost 5-4. But I'll tell you, after seeing them play Pittsburgh and playing the Pens this past week, that really rejuvenated my thoughts on how deep this team can go when they really turn it on.
Yeah, well, they held Pittsburgh to one goal on Wednesday, and then they held Columbus to one goal the other night. So that's two of the best teams in the East. They like to get up and down the ice. They like to fly, and the Hawks only allowed two goals in two games.
Yeah,
so
and two of the best three teams in the East.
Right, they've been ready to go too, Rick. I mean, they've been in the playoffs. I mean, technically they clinched last week. They clinched a spot, but I mean, they've been ready to go for probably about a month now.
Yeah, and I think we've got 3 games left, away games after today, and then we start looking ahead to the playoffs. So, very exciting. Great basketball yesterday. I have to admit, I could not make it for the second game of the Final Four. I saw what the result was. Sam, that must have been something to see.
Yeah, both games came down to the final seconds. Gonzaga was up by 3. They fouled with 7 seconds left. I thought that was a great call by them. South Carolina missed a free throw, and that was pretty much it. And then North Carolina, they missed 4 free throws in a row with a 1-point lead, missed all 4, but got 2 offensive rebounds. They were able to put away Oregon. So now it'll be Gonzaga, North Carolina. I will say one thing. You guys would have been very heated because Phoenix is not prepared for a big event. They closed down the 3 main exits out of the stadium. You couldn't get on the expressway for like a mile around the stadium. It was a complete cluster. It was awful.
Why did they do that? I mean,
I have no idea. It made zero sense. You know, if you go to a big game in Chicago, you get right on the highway, right on the expressway, you get on Lakeshore Drive, whatever. Imagine them locking the 3 biggest bloodlines away from all of the stadiums. It makes no sense.
That's weird. Now, of course, I've got my pet peeve today with the Shamrock Shuffle going on. It looks like the only way I'm going to get to the United Center is if I were to leave and start walking in the next minute or so. Or I think I'm going to have to take the Green Line. It seems like the best way to do it. The streets are going to be a mess downtown today. There's no doubt about that.
I simply don't have the time to read all of the street. I mean, it's amazing,
yes.
These street closings. Between and everything gets underway at 8 o'clock, but there are, you know, everything is in place now. So, you know, the streets are closed. Columbus Drive from Roosevelt to Grand. Grand Avenue from Columbus to State. State from Grand Avenue to Jackson Boulevard, et cetera, et cetera.
Right,
so,
right.
As I've been saying, a lot of street closures in and around the downtown area. So if you're not involved with the race, best to stay away for a while. And everything will not open up completely until 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Right. So let's hope our guests make it to the Showcase studio this morning. I was just thinking about that. Yeah, there's a kind of a rude awakening. But at least they have a nice day to run. You know, I mean, temperatures should be...
Yeah, the rain will hold off till late this afternoon. And it's rather mild, yeah. 46 now, I believe, at O'Hare.
Yeah, and we'll be...
45.
We'll be getting up into the high 50s downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, maybe that's too warm for runners. I don't know.
Would you guys like me to take an order now? I'll bring In-N-Out Burger back next Sunday.
Yeah, what's the temperature there, Sam?
Right now, I'm not sure. Yesterday it was about 77.
Okay, thank you so much.
In-N-Out Burger.
Keep me down for the rest of the show now.
And what time is your reserve time at the pool today?
I'm not sure. Did the pool pretty much all day yesterday. I'm kind of pooled out.
Oh, what a shame. Maybe some golf today, perhaps.
No, I'm going to hang out today. I'm just going to hang out and get ready to go Monday night.
And what time is the game Monday night?
I believe it is at 6:19 local time, so you won't make it. It's 8:19 Chicago time.
Yeah, man. 8:19 Chicago time. Wow, that makes for a late Monday night. I was kind of thinking it would be more like 7, but 8:19 is the tip-off for the NCAA men's tournament. And, of course, we still have the Frozen Four coming to Chicago, too, the men's hockey championship coming to the United Center. I think that's next weekend.
So, yeah, Thursday, I believe. Thursday night.
Thursday night. So, yeah, that all kinds of things going on in this great city, I will tell you.
We can now call it April Madness.
That's right. Correct.
April.
Correct.
No longer March Madness.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and sports. Sam will give us the latest on what's going on with sports as well as the NCAA tournament from Arizona. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. She's at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that number, 312-981-7200. Contact us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is calling his catering company to order food for tonight's Cubs game. Remember, if you have to tune away, you can find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also search, get our podcasts at iTunes just by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking with Mike Mikulka. Mike is president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 704. They represent about 1,000 Environmental Protection Agency workers in the Midwest. And we'll talk about some of President Trump's recent actions, including what his proposed budget would mean involving the EPA and the Great Lakes. Dave's back with a news update at 8. And then we'll speak to my good friend and Tribune colleague, Juan Perez Jr. Juan covers the Chicago Public Schools for the Tribune. We'll talk about the state of the schools and the prospects for help from Springfield, as well as a shortened school calendar. We'll have more news at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin from Western Springs. Leader Durkin will give us the latest Republican perspective on the historic state budget impasse. That's all coming up, but now it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin on this nice, temperate Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. It's 7:25 on the Sunday morning. Time for our weekly spin through national politics. And once again, the focus in Washington has been on President Trump and the allegations of Russian influence in the American political process. The president calls the investigations and the of the activity a witch hunt. His short-term national security advisor and campaign advisor, Michael Flynn, offers to testify before congressional intelligence committees if he gets immunity from prosecution, something Democrats aren't likely to agree on. And then you have the fact that Flynn recently amended financial statements to reveal payments he had received from the Russian state-sponsored broadcasting network, as well as other Russian affiliates. There are also these continued questions about House Intelligence Committee Chairman David Nunes of California obtaining documents on the White House grounds and then turning around and briefing the president. So, yes, it seems like a lot of focus on Russia, but let's turn to the vice chairman of the Senate's Intelligence Committee, Democratic Senator Mark Warner, about why this is all very, very important.
An outside foreign adversary effectively sought to hijack our most critical democratic process, the election of a president. And in that process, decided to favor one candidate over another. I can assure you, they didn't do it because it was in the best interest of the American people. Russia's goal, Vladimir Putin's goal, is a weaker United States, weaker economically, weaker globally, and that should be a concern to all Americans, regardless of party affiliation.
That's Democratic Senator Mark Warner. He's the vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to pick up more on our weekly spin through the national politics throughout the rest of the show. Right now, though, time for a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll continue our weekly spin through the national politics, and we'll also be speaking to Mike Mikulka. He's president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 704, which represents about 1,000 EPA workers in the Midwest, and we'll be talking about the president's proposed EPA budget as well as the proposed zeroing out of funding for Great Lakes restoration.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. A little bit of our continuing spin through the national news. We're talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into alleged Russian influence in the American political system. And while the Senate's investigation looks far more professional than what's going on in the House, their calls for a special independent investigation continue. Here's Democrat Sherry Bustos of Moline speaking on the House floor.
No matter how many times President Trump tries to distract us with a tweet, no matter how many times President Trump's advisors have held secret meetings with the Russians, no matter how many times the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee changes his story to protect President Trump, sooner or later, the truth will come out. Vladimir Putin has a driving mission, and that is to weaken America from within. And so to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, I ask one simple question. What would President Ronald Reagan do? Well, I can tell you, he would put our national security ahead of partisan politics. He would follow the facts, and he would leave no stone unturned. Our democracy demands a complete, thorough, and independent investigation into President Trump's ties with the Putin regime.
But the White House maintains there's nothing there and no Trump relationship with Vladimir Putin in Russia. So why does Mike Flynn want a grant of immunity after Trump during the campaign said only people guilty of a crime want to get immunity? Here's White House spokesman Sean Spicer.
Every single person who's been briefed on this, as I've said ad nauseum from this podium, that they've been very clear that there is no connection between the president or the staff here and anyone doing anything with Russia. Every single person who has been briefed on this situation with respect to the situation with Russia, Republican, Democrat, Obama appointee, career, have all come to the same conclusion.
That's White House spokesman Sean Spicer. Well, we're going to turn our attention now to the president and the issue of the Environmental Protection Agency, actions that he's taken, including his proposed budget, and some of the effects that that could have, particularly here in the Chicago area. Joining me now on the phone is Mike Mikulka, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 704. That local represents about 1,000 Environmental Protection Agency workers in the Midwest. Mike, thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I know one of the first things that kind of got my attention when the Trump budget came out, and one that I know that several environmental groups in the region have been looking at, is the lack of funding for Great Lakes restoration. And in fact, I know that as recently as last week, 63 Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. House sent a letter to the budget committee heads asking for full funding of the federal program. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on what that program actually involves.
Well, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is a program that was started actually under President Bush to restore the Great Lakes. As you may know, there are a number of areas along the Great Lakes that are designated as areas of concern. There's also a number of those areas in Canada. And we have been working for years at the EPA to try to clean up those areas. And the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was a capital influx through the EPA to be able to help the states and local governments do just that. So that's an extra funding that was provided for a number of years to be able to clean up the Great Lakes.
Now, I know that in this budget, the president's proposed taking $50 million out of the fiscal 2017 allotment for his promised border wall on Mexico, as well as zeroing out the $300 million that everybody had sought for fiscal year 2018. Would that just bring everything to a standstill?
I would say so. I mean, in fact, the president's budget, his proposed budget, is so bad. It was even worse than the initial budget that we first were leaked from the White House. But now the president's talking about axing spending for environmental protection down to just $5.7 billion. That amount would zero out spending for 56 programs run by the EPA, including the 100% cut to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And that cut kills 72 federal jobs. Also talking about cutting the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program, killing 40 jobs there, Puget Sound, 6 jobs, and all programs even remotely associated with climate protection, and that's about 224 jobs. Those programs include the Energy Star, which is very popular, and the Green Power Partnership, and 12 other programs. So if that funding is cut, and as you can imagine that we are well into the fiscal year here, we just started the 7th month of the federal fiscal year in April, and we are at level funding from last fiscal year, and by cutting the budget or proposing the cut, that's 17 budget now, essentially, any budget cut that goes into effect is essentially doubled, because you have to take into account that that budget cut is only going to be implemented over 5 months of the remaining part of the year. So it's very devastating to even talk about cutting, you know, a budget at this point in the fiscal year. And all the work that's been done and all the work that was planned for this year, along with the anticipated funding, would have to grind to a halt unless it could be funded through either state or local programs. And the difficulty there, of course, is the president and the administrator have stated that they want to ensure that EPA is not duplicating what the states are doing. And I can assure you that the EPA is not doing that. Practically every day at the EPA, someone from a state agency calls and asks EPA to help them with a project or to take on a project that they do not have the resources to handle, or that they can't take on due to political pressure at the state level. The president's proposed budget cuts EPA funding to run state environmental programs by $482 million per year. That's a 45% cut, down to just $597 million. So if the states can't run their programs now with what EPA gives them in grants, how can they expect it to do that with a 45% cut in funding? That also kills those jobs at the states. So all told, the president's proposing to kill 3,200 good jobs at the EPA based on the proposed budget, But the full scope and the locations of those jobs are not known until the detailed budget comes out in about mid-May.
We're speaking with Mike Mikulka. He's president of AFGE. That's the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 704. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We're speaking with Mike Mikulka, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 704, which represents about 1,000 environmental protection agency workers in the Midwest. We're talking about the proposed budget for the EPA from the president and some of the effects that would have. Mike, I wanted to know if you could perhaps give me a bit more specifics about this Great Lakes program. About what, when it comes to restoring the restoration initiative, what actually is the work that takes place in this?
Well, there's a lot of work, as you can imagine, getting from a degraded state in the environment to a final assessment of whether you've cleaned something up. So typically what happens is there is environmental contamination that has to be cleaned up, and that's not done under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Usually it's done under a different program, such as Superfund or the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, where there's a cleanup that occurs, or the Clean Water Act. And then we have, let's say, a habitat restoration that has to occur in order to make the resource, bring it back to whole. So the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative would fund things such as planning and the actual carrying out of the habitat restoration, and then there'd be monitoring associated with that to ensure that the resource is actually brought back to standards. So a lot of that goes into that. Those are examples of what might happen under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
One thing I was wondering is Asian carp barrier fall under this?
The Asian carp barrier. You know, off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that.
Because I know part of this was about reducing invasive species, and given the concerns about the Asian carp and the electronic barrier that's been put up to prevent them from migrating from the Illinois through the Illinois River into Lake Michigan is something that I know still has a lot of concern among a number of people. I noticed that in the Washington Post on Friday, they said that the new EPA documents reveal even deeper proposed cuts to staff and programs than at first thought. And you touched on some of this, but basically, according to the Post, laying off 25% of its employees, scrapping 56 programs, including pesticide safety, water runoff control, environmental cooperation with Mexico and Canada under NAFTA. We'd also be turning over the fuel efficiency standards monitoring to the automakers rather than having the government do this. It seems like some pretty significant changes to this agency. And, of course, it's an agency that, you know, has come under fire. Is it too burdensome? Is it too regulatory? Those kinds of things.
I think that the issue of whether or not EPA creates jobs or kills jobs is been answered. The EPA creates jobs. Basically, the programs that are put in place by the EPA have created thousands of jobs going forward. There's been nothing has been shown that there's anything on the horizon or in the past that shows that there's jobs that are killed. If a job is lost in one area, then a job is created in another area, and that's what that's what drives the economy forward, because innovation drives the economy. So if you look at the cuts, though, that the president has proposed that have just come out, that were just announced at the end of last week, it seems like every time we turn over a stone or we hear something new, it's even worse than it was before. And the president now has proposed to cut EPA's 17 budget by $247 million. Now, recognizing that we're going forward under a continuing resolution at last year's budget, and we're into the seventh month of the fiscal year already, the continuing resolution that we're under expires on April 28th, and we're at the same level funding from FY 2016. So the EPA doesn't have an approved budget for FY 2017, but the current levels are consistent with the two-year deal for the budget that was reached in 2015 by Congress. So to try to cut that budget now is really breaking that deal that was agreed to in 2015.
And so what happens when we get to April 28th?
Well, April 28th, we're either going to have another continuing resolution to fund the programs through the end of the fiscal year for all the federal agencies, or we may have a government shutdown, which is, I don't think anybody wants a government shutdown. But if you look at even the cuts that are proposed, the president has said and the administrator has said that they want to push the programs that EPA is working on to the states. But the cuts that are being proposed are illogical because they've proposed cutting $115 million from grants to the states, which I already mentioned are strapped and can't do their work under
especially budget. Illinois, as we well know.
Absolutely. So they're proposing to cut $48 million cut to EPA R&D as well. And that's another thing that doesn't make sense with the proposed budget, because they've said that they want to base EPA decisions on sound science, yet the cut for the FY17 budget is $48 million cut to EPA R&D, which is a 10% cut from existing levels. But when you only have 5 months left in the fiscal year to implement that, that's greater than a 20% cut.
Right, the compounding effect of over that short-term period. I know another thing that was in this Washington Post story was that in cuts to these scientific programs, that the administrator's own science advisory board budget would be cut 84%. And the document explained it's because they wouldn't need that much money due to anticipated lower number of peer reviews. And so, you know, those reviews are basically include things like climate change.
Right. So anytime a controversial project comes forward, it's supposed to be reviewed by the Science Advisory Board. But if you cut that budget, then it's unlikely that you'll be able to produce anything out of the Science Advisory Board. At the same time, the president's budget proposes that we're reducing funding for R&D by 48%. So if you're going to cut the funding for science, it doesn't seem illogical that you'd have less documents to review because you've cut the funding, so you're not creating the science, so there'll be less science to review. It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So where do you see this going in Congress?
I'm hopeful. I remain hopeful that the Congress will look at this and say, this doesn't make sense. We have made so many environmental gains, and to try to cut the budget this drastically for EPA just really disrupts everything that has been going on since 1972 when the EPA was created. You know, we are down significantly in terms of number of staff at the EPA. If you look at historically the budget, I think the height of EPA's staffing was in 1999 when there was over 18,000 staff at the EPA. The current budget only funds less than 15,400 staff nationwide. So that's the budget, you know, the number of staff was already down 15%, and the budget in 1999 was $7.6 billion. Today it's just over $8.1 billion. That doesn't keep up with inflation. I would argue that that's about the best $8.1 billion value the American taxpayer is getting for their money in the whole federal bureaucracy.
Are some of these states that are more dependent on EPA projects that, you know, as we've talked about, that can't afford to take on these things themselves, are they weighing in on this federal budget issue?
I would hope they are. I haven't seen a lot of correspondence from the states. I know that the Environmental Consortium of States sent a letter to EPA saying they didn't agree with the extent of the budget cuts. I saw a letter from the Pennsylvania DEP saying they didn't agree with the cuts that were proposed. So I would hope that the states are weighing in on these issues, because it really affects them. And the states, you know, going forward, the states have already passed their budgets, and they have counted on the federal money coming in under the existing budgets, some of which expire on June 30th. So if you're not going to get that money, then already you're running at a budget deficit, because the money that you counted on from EPA has not come in. And so you have probably have to make a budget cuts at the state level already in order to not run a budget deficit. So the whole thing is just a cascading effect that makes no sense.
Absolutely. Mike Mikulka, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 704. Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on these dramatic effects that could take place with the Environmental Protection Agency.
I wish we had more time, Rick, but thank you for having me on the show.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to my good friend and colleague, Chicago Tribune Chicago Public Schools reporter Juan Perez Jr. We'll be talking about the state of CPS and what may be next in the budget battles that the public schools are facing.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Tribune Tower, historic Tribune Tower, lost perhaps in all of the talk about the Russian alleged influence in the political system of U.S. and Illinois. There's also the fact that there's Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, facing Senate confirmation. More Democrats are planning to vote no and to filibuster, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is threatening to use the nuclear option and change the rules to permit consideration of the nomination with a simple majority. On the outside, groups are working both for and against the nomination. Now, here's one ad from the NRA from neighboring Missouri, and the NRA is putting $1 million behind support for Gorsuch. And this is their message to Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill.
Claire McCaskill talks a good game on gun rights.
I'm a Second Amendment advocate. I was raised in a hunting culture in rural Missouri.
When McCaskill voted to put anti-gun justices on the Supreme Court, not once, but twice. Now Claire McCaskill has another chance, and your freedom is on the line. Tell Senator McCaskill, don't let us down again. Vote to confirm Judge Neil Gorsuch. The Missouri men and women of the National Rifle Association are responsible for the content of this advertising.
Now, there's also another group. They're called the Constitutional Responsibility Project, and they've got their own ads up, and they're running ads urging a Senate defeat of the Gorsuch nomination.
Luke might learn a skill in a particular classroom with one teacher, but be unable to perform it in any other setting.
Luke's dad wanted a better education for his autistic son, but as a judge, Neil Gorsuch ruled that because Luke is autistic, he deserved only the bare minimum. Thankfully, the Supreme Court voted unanimously to reject Gorsuch's heartless approach. Now Donald Trump wants to give Gorsuch a lifetime appointment on that same court. Only the Senate can stop him. Tell senators, our children deserve better. Vote no on Gorsuch.
So there you have the battle of the airwaves over the Supreme Court nomination. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase Studios, my good friend Juan Perez Jr. He is the Chicago Public Schools reporter for my great employer and yours, the Chicago Tribune. Thank you so much for getting up with me this morning.
Thank you for having me. This is always fun, and hopefully I'm caffeinated enough to...
You're always caffeinated enough. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. And there's always no shortage of things to talk about when it comes to the Chicago Public Schools. Is that a sigh?
Is that
the weight of your work just kind of weighing down on your vocal cords there?
I feel like every time I come into the show, I start my session with some kind of sigh or something like that. It's true. But no, it's crunch time. It's for the Chicago Public School System. It's April 2nd, 8:11. A.M. And in about an hour, CPS CEO Forrest Claypool is going to be on the far south side on about 114th Street speaking to a church group Sunday morning, pressing his case and the district's case for the lawsuit that is currently carrying out against the state. what a lot of people have described as a last-ditch effort to get some kind of...
It's a Hail Mary.
I mean, it's a last-second heave here. So he's going to be pushing that case. He's going to be pressing...
Well, let's explain what that lawsuit is.
See, here's I guess, one of the fundamental arguments that's involved. CPS says that, listen, for every dollar that, you know, we get from the state, if you add all that together, it is well short of where we should be. It is only of a fraction of what other students in the state get. I mean, you know, as far as that pool of funding is concerned. The state would argue that, well, wait a minute, that's not true at all, because if you take a look at every pool of money that we give you, CPS, you actually get a lot more than other kids in the state. That is, of course, if you don't count the state's contribution to CPS's massive pension bill, which is always a perennial, at least recently, really difficult thing for the district to actually cut a check to cover. So that's the fundamental argument, I think, that's happening right now in the courts and in Springfield as well, is, you know, how much money should CPS get from the state to cover this, what's currently, I think, a $721 million pension payment that's due at the end of June, which is normally, that's a big expense, obviously. But as we all know, the pressures of the district's budget situation have increased to a point where cutting a check that size is really difficult to do without completely running the ship aground.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Financially speaking.
But I mean, I think there were valid questions, though, of whether to incorporate the $215 million from the state that was...
An assumption that the state wouldn't have.
Well, that was a conditional on a larger public employee pension bill passing.
Sure.
And in the absence of that, Governor Rauner vetoed it. And now basically has been traveling the rest of the state back using the language that, well, this is a bailout of the Chicago Public Schools without the larger pension picture being looked at.
You know, the state has always been pretty insistent saying, listen, CPS, why did you even bother passing a budget that assumed that you were going to get $215 million from us when you knew that it was contingent on this sort of broader pension reform? But yet again, you know, that's the second year in a row that the district has been in a position where it said, okay, well, we're just going to assume the state's going to send us hundreds of millions of dollars to help balance our budget. It was a lot more money last year. You remember it was like somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million that they were assuming the
right.
state was going to send along. That never happened. They found a way to engineer their way out of that hole. And now they've got some more cost-cutting to do if they're going to be able to put it all together. And I'm still not quite sure on how the numbers are going to add up or what the engineering tactic, the financial engineering tactic, so to speak, is going to be this time around.
Well, and we've also seen the rhetoric kind of ratchet up that $215 million was a one-time payment. And now on the city side, it's like, well, there ought to be a permanent
And so this is where it's going to get into this whole idea of a new school funding formula, right? That's the big piece of game that we're trying to all chase down here. But it's
still the same game, you know. No, I mean it really. It, in many respects, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for decades there's been talk about how to reform the way that Illinois funds its public schools and remove it from the property tax dependency, and that zip codes determine the quality of an education based on property wealth, which was, you know, is a 17th century measure of agrarian wealth.
Yeah.
And you know,
nice. Yeah.
And that hasn't changed. You look at the issue of pensions and changing pensions and even if the bill that was the precondition to get Chicago that $215 million, even for it to pass, it'd be in court the next day. There would be, you know, maybe at least 6 months, if not a year, before a ruling by the Illinois Supreme Court on whether it was constitutional.
Can't pass constitutional muster, that's for sure.
But then people try to factor in that as, oh, well, we'd save $1 billion if this passed. Well, no, you wouldn't save it if it passed. You'd save it, perhaps, if it became law. And there are valid questions of law. Senate President John Cullerton has said that he believes his model for the pensions is constitutional.
Maybe.
He's a lawyer.
I'm not.
But, it might be.
Right.
But when they passed the previous bill to deal with public employee pensions at the state, that was struck down wholeheartedly by the Illinois Supreme Court.
Wholeheartedly. So that brings us to 8:16 on Sunday.
On a Sunday morning.
April 2nd. You know, but I mean, now what's the plan, right? I mean, that's the critical question here.
That's a great tease. Hold it right
okay,
there.
Okay.
All right. What's the plan? We're speaking with Juan Perez Jr. He's Chicago Tribune's Chicago Public Schools reporter. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. April 19 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by my good friend and colleague at the Chicago Tribune, Juan Perez Jr. We're talking about the Chicago Public Schools, and we left this conversation before the break on what's the plan. Well, what is the plan? what do they say the plan is, or do they have a plan other than abruptly ending the school year?
Yeah, so that's the interesting point to make here. Before the break, we were talking about the Hail Mary, right? The lawsuit
which speaking of which, and this was part of my further rant, was we've also been down that road before,
right?
About the adequacy of funding schools in Illinois, and the Illinois Supreme Court, in a famous decision, ruled that the constitutional requirement that the state be the primary source of funding education was a goal and not a mandate.
Well, that's pretty clear language. So, you know, and then you know, you have there's also court precedent that would suggest that, at least from the state's perspective, that, you know, hashing these really thorny, difficult, complex, controversial questions out is the responsibility of the legislative branch and not the judiciary, right?
Correct.
And other states have confronted that same question. So, you know,
although other states have acted differently. I mean, Michigan, you know, decade or so ago went through a massive court-ordered refinancing of the way it does its public schools.
And maybe you get to that point here. And I don't want to say that's not something that is feasible or even possible here in the state of Illinois. Sure, you can get there. But other entities have tried before. You know, obviously the Urban League in its, you know, years-long battle with the state of Illinois, addressing some of the same but not all of the same questions. But this is the same concept, I guess. And now we're in Cook County Chancery Court trying to see how this sort of, how this issue is going to advance through that realm. And not only advance through that realm, but CPS says that they want to have some kind of decision in hand by May 1st.
Right.
And a decision that will, it's a decision that will allow them somehow to determine whether or not they're going to cut the school year off by as many as 3 weeks. At least that's what they've said publicly, right? Like, this is something that came out in these legal filings that, you know, without some kind of favorable preliminary decision from Ulysses Valderrama there in Cook County, the school district faces the very real prospect of ending the year about 3 calendar weeks early.
But that affects their funding.
It does. They will lose some money from the state if they do that. Overall, you know, I think they're looking at saving somewhere in the range of $90 to $96 million. Like, according to their calculations that they, that they've concluded, they tell us anyway, that's how much money they could save net of whatever penalty you get from the state. But the point is, you know, there's a lot of anxiety out there right now, and I don't just mean among parents and students. I mean, certainly among teachers, among administrators, you know, people who are actually out on the street making this giant machine run in the way that it does, and central office too, of trying to figure out what's actually going to happen here and trying to make plans too. Because, I mean, if you have kids in the system and you're looking at the prospect of the school year shutting down 3 weeks early, Jesse Sharkey, the vice president of the Chicago Teachers Union, the other day was out in front of school district headquarters saying, do I need to call my mother-in-law to have her come in to, like, help take care of my kid? You know, I mean, those are real questions. Those that you've got to figure out. Vacations, and not to mention graduations, end of year testing, you know, those sorts of critical end of year decisions that a school building has to make to actually wind the year down in a proper way. And, you know, if I'm Mayor Rahm Emanuel, you know, I don't know what he's thinking, and I don't claim to, but I have to imagine that the idea of cutting 3 weeks off the school year would be an absolute non-starter over my dead body kind of thing, you know, especially after all the campaigning that he did on a longer school day, a longer school year, the expense of political capital there to actually pull the trigger on something like that. That would be a tough decision. Like, that's the understatement of the year. But
so where does CTU fit into this whole picture? I mean, you know, the talk of a one-day strike and things like that.
Well, if anything, a one-day strike, which they are considering taking on May 1st, would save CPS about $11 million in operational expenses. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, but we are in a spot where, you know, these margins are getting kind of razor thin, and $11 million bucks can make a difference when you're trying to stockpile cash and get ready to kind of, you know, pay the bills.
Faced with cutting the check, yes.
Right. So, you know, that's not an insignificant amount of money. But at the same time, I think the CTU, at least its leadership, sees this idea of taking on a one-day strike as something similar to what they did last year, is we need to call attention to the fiscal crisis that's facing the school district. We need to call attention to some of our ideas, which would be, you know, I think some... some of the ideas are like, you know, corporate head tax and, you know, it's another sweep of some kind of city funding sweep into the school district, or obviously an elected school board is something that they've pushed pretty hard for. And you saw him in Springfield this last week also pushing for legislation that would vastly expand the landscape under which they can bargain with Chicago Public Schools. That's a whole other thing that
right.
we can talk about. But CTU is confronting a pretty, I think, what Jesse Sharkey and other leaders there have acknowledged is a very difficult internal conversation as to whether this one-day strike makes any kind of sense whatsoever, and whether, you know, taking another day of instructional time from kids when faced with the prospect of 3 weeks getting cut off makes sense, whether the messaging is consistent, you know. And, you know, that's all going to probably come to a head here this week when union delegates get together again to kind of decide formally whether to take another step forward and actually schedule a, you know, another kind of vote, you know, an official internal vote that will determine whether or not the union actually does stage this walkout. All that being said, you know, there's a lot of questions like, wait a minute, why is the teachers union striking? I thought they just settled a contract. And yeah, they did. And no, they're not striking over that contract. And no, they are not striking under the...
It's a symbol.
It's a symbol, and it's one that's gonna, you know, be the subject of another kind of wonky legal battle, you know, in front of the State Educational Labor Relations Board, and potentially even maybe someday a circuit court or a Supreme Court judge, a panel of judges, to decide whether, you know, the union can even do something like this outside of the bounds of, you know, state
of
law,
the contract,
and, yeah, of the contract, and, you know, all that stuff. So yeah, CTU is calling for revenue. They're calling for revenue and from spots that I think would be pretty difficult to pull off, you know, like a corporate head tax here in the city. You know, I think that would not fly with that. Well, I mean,
no, and that's and here again, this is something that even if it were, you know, possible, it's not going to be quick.
Right.
It doesn't address the real
June
kind of
30th.
Compressed time frame,
yeah,
that everything is under right now.
So and so here we are, and is the school district going to come up with? I think there's a lot of folks out there who sort of treat the school system's warnings of danger with a certain degree of cynicism. Because
for some valid reasons,
because I never underestimate the city and the school district's ability to pull some kind of rabbit out of a hat at the last second to stave off disaster for at least another fiscal year. And that's entirely, you know, it's entirely possible that some other financial engineering effort can materialize here in time to make it work somehow, you know. But at the same time, you know, you look at the numbers and,
it's pretty bleak.
The bank account is empty.
It's
pretty close.
It's pretty bleak. Juan Perez Jr., my Chicago Tribune colleague, thank you so much for joining me this morning
for
that optimistic update on the Chicago Public Schools.
You know me, man. I'm always really good.
You are a realist, that's for sure. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we're going to be speaking to Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. My good friends at the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois are once again having their annual On the Road to Literacy Tutor and Adult Learner Conference, and that's coming up on Saturday. That's at the University of Illinois, Chicago. You can get more details on this by going to lvillinois.org. It's a great workshop, great kind of lessons for people to help everyone become more literate. And frankly, as I've always said, if you work for a newspaper, if you're a journalist, we want to do our best to make sure that we have a literate and informed public as they decide to make their decisions. We, in the last half hour, I mentioned some of the ad wars going on with the Supreme Court nomination of Neil Gorsuch, and Illinois' two Democratic senators have made clear their feelings on Gorsuch. They're no votes. Here's the state's senior senator, Democrat Dick Durbin, explaining his rationale.
The Supreme Court must serve as an independent check on President Trump, not a rubber stamp. But Judge Gorsuch wouldn't even comment on the original meaning of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, apparently for fear of possibly implicating the president who nominated him. Judge Gorsuch may not be the first nominee to have avoided answering questions, but he went further than others. As a result, members of the committee can only look to his judicial record and his work for the Justice Department to decide their vote for this lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court. His record on the bench and at the Justice Department make it clear that Judge Gorsuch is not the right person to serve on the highest court in the land. We want judges to follow the law and apply the facts fairly, but it's naive to believe that this is some kind of robotic exercise.
That's Illinois Senior Senator Democrat Dick Durbin. Well, joining me now on the phone is Jim Durkin. He is the Illinois House Republican leader from Western Springs. And I wanted to have Leader Durkin on to kind of get his take of the ever-evolving situation in Springfield that leads to no end. Leader Durkin, thank you for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Glad to be on. I wish I could be in studio, but the Bank of America run has shuffled me off course, and I'm in a very quiet, obscure toe zone area that I think I'm in good position until the I get hooked up by the tow truck, and then maybe we'll lose some of that clarity we have right now. But good morning, Rick.
Good morning, and I have to apologize. And truly, I did not know the Shamrock Shuffle was this morning until this morning. So I would have sent you plenty of advice if I had known, and that's my fault. But thank you
well,
for
Rick, both of us being the health nuts that we are. Both of us, if we would have known, we would be running right now. Correct?
Oh yeah, right. And in fact, I was going to actually say that you were parking your car so you could take place in the run as well. But yes, but we all know better than that. But seriously, thanks for accommodating us. You know, we've seen ups and downs in the last month or so about whether we can get to any resolution of this budget impasse, particularly efforts made on the side of the Senate. Between Democratic President John Cullerton and Senate Republican Leader Chris Redonio, the so-called grand bargain. And it just seems more and more clear that this doesn't look like it's going anywhere.
Well, they got out of the box and back in the earlier in the year, and things didn't quite work out. But I applaud both the leaders in the Senate for moving forward and trying to construct a deal which would, at least the intentions were, that would respect the priorities of both parties and also bring a resolution to this impasse, pay down our deficits, get back to reforming our pension systems and helping our business community. But things have fallen astray. There is a window of opportunity for us to get this done over the next 2 months. I know most people down there feel that, you know, that there's no resolution in sight, but I do talk to the rank and file on a regular day, not only from my caucus, but also the Democrat caucus. And to say that there is a desire to bring this to resolution is an understatement. So we still have time. I am not throwing in the towel. I hope that the Senate will continue with their work and get the best deal that they can. That means that, you know, it's not one-sided. You know, the Democrats will be asking a lot from us, but the fact is we need to ask, you know, the same. So I think, as I said, we got some time, but this needs to come to conclusion. It's the right thing for the state of Illinois on so many levels. And I just look at what's the debt that is being piled up, services that are no longer have been struggling for the past 2 years, and the list goes on and on. But the fact is, let's get this done.
But haven't we gotten to the point where really 2018 politics has infected the process so badly that the motivations of reaching a settlement, the idea of, you know, political blame game, have just gotten so great, and the enmity among the enmity between Governor Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan has grown so great that there is no impetus for compromise.
Well, clearly there's, I think that the Speaker's conflict with the governor was front and center this week on two major initiatives. And one of them is the sale of the Thompson Center, and that's a piece of legislation that has been around for 3 years, and we've been ready. I sent a letter to the Speaker back in February saying, you know, what are your problems with this? Because he made a statement that, you know, he has some technical concerns with the legislation. I wrote a letter to him asking him to please raise those issues with us. Let's resolve it. Let's get this piece of property off the state ledger, put it back in the tax rolls. And then just a few days back, the Speaker threw cold water on it with a litany of reasons why he said it was not acceptable, which I don't accept. And earlier in the week was an excellent idea from the governor from over a year and a half ago, which would allow for a managed lane system on I-55, the most populated and the busiest freeway in Illinois, which, again, Speaker threw cold water on it. And I'm getting to a point where I believe the Speaker is more interested in ensuring that this governor does not get a legislative success that continues to starting to percolate more and more. But I will say this, his members are not accepting of this. His members need to rise up and say, put it aside. The elections will come and go. But I do believe that the gubernatorial race and blocking the governor from getting any type of legislative success seems to be more apparent. So I'm concerned with that. And, you know, Democrats have feelings about the governor one way or the other. But look at this. Whether it's a president or a governor, if either one of them fails, you know, the nation and the state fails. And that's not acceptable to me. I have made it very clear for 2 years. And, I don't know how many times I got to say this, but myself and my members are willing to negotiate with the Speaker on every issue. And we're not getting there. And every year we do this, we go through this exercise where we have working groups on every one of the major issues that we think are important. And then all of a sudden we think we reach some conclusion. And then all of a sudden the Democrats walk away from the table and they throw together a ridiculously unbalanced budget and they expect us to support it, but we don't. And it's just more politics, more political theater, more gotcha votes, and that's not the way to govern.
We're speaking with Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Joining me on the phone is the Shamrock Shuffle hampered Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin, joining me by phone, and unfortunately couldn't wander his way through the street closings to get into the studio today. Leader Durkin, you alluded to, as far as the issue of the sale of the Thompson Center, about that you wrote a letter to Speaker Madigan to, after all this time, what are your real objections here? The fact that you had to write a letter, do you guys talk at all?
Not often. Good question. Not often. I have a respectful relationship with the speaker, but I don't have the luxury that senators, Senator Cullerton and Redonio have, which they have, they're very conversive and it's a different personality. I've worked with the speaker for years, but we have limited conversation, and it's usually only when there's a matter at hand, which we have to discuss issues. But I have made it very clear publicly that I've stated it to him at the floor during the when we were sworn in January about our willingness to work with you. But I don't believe I need to come in on bended knee to ask for permission or to. He knows where I'm at. If he wants to work with me, we're open. We want to get it done.
Is part of the problem really, in some sense, the politics of this era? I mean, you've been around for a long time, as have I, and where the power in politics has become so concentrated. And I'm not just speaking of the speaker. I'm talking about, as well, with Governor Rauner and his financial resources, which basically have revitalized a Illinois Republican Party. But just that we have these two spheres of power, control over campaign funds, campaign resources, the ability to threaten members with primary challenges. I mean, has the stakes of power become so great that is our politics today, and that's also the politics of gridlock?
It's the politics of Washington. It's the politics of Springfield, where it's a tough business, and anybody who wants to get into this needs to realize it's not powder puff. It's hand-to-hand combat. And I just watch what's going on in Washington, and
Springfield didn't used to be that way. Was different.
No, Rick, remember, Springfield wasn't that way. But for the last 12 years, the Democrats have had plenary control over Springfield, so the Republicans really were not part of the equation. Republicans, they really didn't need our advice, our counsel, nor our votes. But now it's become different because we have, and just remember, the Democrats historically have outspent Republicans year in, year out for so many years. But now we have a governor that is saying no, who's a different governor than we've seen ever in Springfield, who's willing to back it up with his resources. We won some races too. So the fact is that the Democrats are not used to having Republicans push back and not being, holding tough and saying no, and not being intimidated or scared or being muscled into submission on certain votes. It's a tough business, but the fact is we're standing up. We are standing up to the status quo, which put this state in the position that it currently is. We've got $12 billion of backlog bills. We've got a $100 billion underfunded pension systems. Republicans want to get these things resolved, and there's no rush to resolve these things right now. And as we said earlier, I think this is going back to the governor's race for 2018.
Well, and one question I do have, though, is, and yes, the Republicans have been the minority party in the legislature, but when you look at what's ahead to try to fix things, if we're truly ever going to get to that stage and not just see the state fall sliding off the cliff, it's going to take some very difficult votes that aren't necessarily votes that Republicans would ordinarily take, such as a tax increase.
Rick, I have stated that over and over again that I am willing to take votes that I probably would have never taken before to break the impasse, because it is the best thing for the state of Illinois. But it's more than just a tax increase. It's about fixing our pension systems. It's about improving our business environment. And those have to be part of the equation. That is why it's not a one-way street anymore. There has to be systematic change in Springfield and how we treat, our business community, how we handle our pension systems. And I'll give you an example of just the willingness on behalf of what I'm trying to do. Just a week and a half ago, I introduced a comprehensive pension bill, which would have helped the city of Chicago out with their pension parity payment. But I purposely had 26 co-sponsors placed in the bill. Those are 26 House Republicans who are prepared to vote for, next to breaking, solving the budget, of taking on the next biggest issue we have is our our crumbling pension systems, but our 26 votes reflects our proportionate share under a structured roll call to get this done. What that means is that we're prepared to do business. We've got our votes ready. So I've worked with my caucus. I talked to them a lot. We're prepared to negotiate and resolve it. And if the Democrats do not do it on the House, because the House Democrats refuse to take up this offer, then it has nothing to do with anything else, anything other than ensuring that the governor gets no success, no wins, to have him walk into the 2018 election in a difficult situation, with not showing any major accomplishment, which, as I said earlier, if the governor fails, the state fails, and that's not acceptable for me.
Speaking of that pension bill, and obviously you're a lawyer and I'm not, but you're confident that that plan, which is, I guess, Senate President Cullerton's proposal using the consideration model, you do believe that that's constitutional?
I believe it is. We have a better shot at having the Supreme Court uphold this than obviously what happened to Senate Bill 1 a few years back. We take out retirees. We don't touch them. The consideration model is something which the labor unions endorsed 3 years ago during the last pension scrum. This is a good portion of it is what the We Are One coalition backed up, and that the president of the Senate was confident that this would have this would meet constitutional standards.
But when the union backed that, that was before the Supreme Court issued its ruling on Senate Bill 1, which...
Well, you know, they just can't pivot so quickly. This was part of what they believed, and they put their backing into was on this consideration model. I, as a lawyer, believe that, you know, the relationship that we have between the state systems and also the employees, the court has said is the contractual relationship. The contracts can be modified under this consideration. This goes back to the common law. Now, it's a little more involved than that, but I believe we it's been almost 2 years, Rick, since we've looked, since this opinion came down from the Supreme Court. But to stick our head in the sand and not do anything right now is beyond legislative negligence. So I believe that we have a better shot at it. I've looked at certain parts of the opinion that came down a couple of years ago, and I believe they gave an opening for us to be able to move forward under this consideration argument. Lawyers are going to disagree. That's what we do. But the fact is, I believe that we have to move forward and let the courts do their analysis and let the chips fall where they may. But I believe that this has a better chance of withstanding the scrutiny of the Supreme Court. Now, the consideration model is if that was to be found constitutional, we believe that that's a $1.25 million savings right out of the box. The other parts of the bill, which we believe are there's no constitutional consideration at all, would have a $1 billion savings. But if that portion is found unconstitutional, we do have other aspects of the pension reform bill that will provide meaningful savings, which are going to help stabilize these systems and take the burden off the state budget, which we currently are dealing with because of these enormous pension payments that we are now making with our general revenue funds.
Leader Durkin, thank you so much. And maybe we could move to have a constitutional amendment to ban legislative negligence in the state constitution. I like that phrase.
You like that?
I like that phrase.
Trumpers over here.
Well, thank you so
much. It's not too late to jump into the race. I can see him from a distance.
Thank you so much, and I hope you get out of that toe zone very quickly. I appreciate you joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Mike Mikulka, Juan Perez Jr., and Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening, and now it's time to turn things over to the great Dean Richards.
Have you figured out your strategy of getting over to the United Center yet on the Shamrock Shuffle morning?
Appropriately enough, I'll take the green line.
Now that makes
sense. How about that?
Yeah, that makes sense for the Shamrock Shuffle.
I mean, I thought we were done with St. Patrick's Day.
I'm a little surprised that the Shamrock Shuffle is this late, especially given... Do I remember correctly, but right around St. Patrick's Day, wasn't it 70 degrees? Wasn't it super nice weather right around then?
And
maybe
plus
not on that day.
No,
but
also,
then.
And it was a whole week-long thing, you know. So now we're into April.
Right.
And it's still St. Patrick's.
Should be the April Fool's Day run.
That's how you would find me in this run. I would be the April Fool.
If it were a joke like that.
Yes.
We've got a short show today because of an early Blackhawks game that you will find Rick someplace in the crowd. Today, so get out of his way if you're on the green line. Make room. Mr. Pearson's coming through. We'll be here till 11 o'clock with lots of festivities and checking in with Sam Panionovich, who is
lounging
live at
lounging
in Phoenix. I saw the picture on Facebook.
Yes, we
he's in a chaise lounge. Yes, he's having it looked like a fruity cocktail. At it's 7 o'clock in the morning in Phoenix. For that fruity cocktail that he seems to be enjoying there. We'll talk to him coming up in just a few minutes.